The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Well, UK politics has entered a new phase of volatility following Sir Keir Starmer's decision to resign. Andy Burnham has quickly become a focal point in the realignment, while Nigel Farage continues to shape the political agenda, although questions about his and Reform's finances continue to swirl around. What is emerging is a political landscape that remains institutionally intact, but increasingly fragmented in authority, in narrative, and in purpose. To explore the wider sense of malaise, we're joined by novelist and satirist Jonathan Coe. Jonathan, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, first of all, that malaise, I mean, do you sense it in your own life?
Well, it's a kind of constant background noise that you can't really ignore. And the volatility that has characterized British politics for the last 10 years, really, ever since the Brexit referendum, makes a deep psychological difference to life here, I think.
So on the one hand, you've got a Labour Party saying, you know, we've got to make Brexit work. And then you'll have people like Nigel Farage, who led the charge into Brexit, saying, well, you didn't do it properly. If you'd only done Brexit fully, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in. It's all your fault.
Yeah, it's amazing how Mr. Farage manages to find these kind of rhetorical manoeuvres to make out that he and his supporters are always the kind of victims and would always have done things right if only they were allowed to. I mean, alarmingly, we might get the chance to have that put to the test in a few years' time if God forbid, Reform are allowed to form a government. The thing that astonishes me about the support, the groundswell of support for Nigel Farage, is that he's never governed anything in his life. You know, his stock in trade is shouting from the sidelines and complaining and saying that, everything is being done wrong and he would do it right, but he never tells us how. So, we may get a chance to find out exactly what he would do before too long.
Do you think that his image has become a little bit tarnished by the revelations about his very dodgy finances?
It's always hard to know how far these things are cutting through and whether, it's clear that he has major questions to answer about his financial affairs. And, when you consider the outrage that Keir Starmer was subjected to for, what was it, taking some couple of free football tickets to an Arsenal game and a few clothes, I think, it does seem kind of extraordinary when you read the kind of sums that are involved in Reform and Mr. Farage's donations.
To what extent do you think that the public generally has become a bit politically illiterate because maybe they don't read in their newspapers any of the long articles anymore. They're looking at those little tidbits on TikTok to inform them. And that is not necessarily a comprehensive political education.
Yeah, I think this is a problem. And, sometimes I think that instead of talking all the time about the rise of populism, we should be talking about the rise of simplism, which is a facet of populism, really. And the idea that, if politicians try to present events to us as nuanced and complicated, then they're really just trying to pull the wool over our eyes, and everything, in fact, is very simple. And, if any people had the guts to get on with it, then these problems could be solved. I think that's a very dangerous point of view, because reality is incredibly complex and the political problems facing us all are very intractable and complex. Even for me, who makes a kind of profession of it, trying to keep up with everything that is happening politically is a challenge.
Now, you are a novelist and also a satirist, and among your influences, Flann O'Brien at Swim Two Birds. You also quote Joseph Heller, the author of Catch-22, famously, among your influences. Is it possible in the age we now live in, with Trump in the White House and Farage, I suppose, knocking at the door of number 10, is it possible to satirize the ridiculous now?
It's more a question of just standing back and letting the figures themselves do it, really. Trump is self-satirizing. Boris Johnson, when he was Prime Minister in the UK, was self-satirizing as well. And they kind of do it to try and endear themselves to their supporters, but it can also backfire on them and make themselves look kind of ridiculous, I think. it's funny that you mentioned Flann O'Brien, because I was thinking of him this morning, as I often do, actually, and wondering what he would have made of figures like Donald Trump and Nigel Farage and others. We could really do with some of that kind of incredible sense of the absurd and incisiveness now.
Now, the question of the absurd, I mean, that's where satire tends to go. You take a reality and, I suppose, exaggerated and twisted somewhat. But the reality of politics is sometimes so absurd that it might be beyond satire.
I think you just have to take a different approach. I mean, in my new novel, The Proof of My Innocence, there are a lot of quotations from contemporary politicians, but I don't put words into their mouth. I just use things that they've said in interviews and in speeches and let them speak for themselves, really. And you know, you only have to kind of juxtapose the statements, really, with the reality that they're supposed to be commenting on. And the absurdity is there already.
Now, the premiership of Liz Truss, mercifully brief, but the obvious sense of delusion that she has about herself is something that is inherently comedic.
It is inherently comedic. I mean, maybe I'm becoming a bit of a softy in my old age, but I also find something slightly poignant about it. And when I reached the end of my novel, I realized that the heroine and the narrator of the novel actually had something in common with Liz Truss, because they were both trying to tell stories to themselves and to other people, to explain something that had happened to them that had kind of gone horribly wrong. And I find it fascinating that she's gone so far down this rabbit hole of delusion and conspiracy theory in order to create a story for herself, to kind of explicate herself for what happened during her 7 weeks in power.
The notion of the Little Englander, is that still an aspiration? Is it still alive and well?
I mean, I guess it is. There was a lot of that behind the Brexit vote. I mean, there were many complex and various reasons for why different people voted for Brexit, but I think there was a strong element of Little Englandism in it. And I've just finished a new novel, actually, which is not set in the present at all. It's set more than 100 years ago, but it kind of tries to argue for an English patriotism in a way, which is a bit more inclusive and a bit more ironic and a bit more generous than what we're seeing, certainly on the streets of England at the moment, with the Raise the Colours campaign and so on.
Is there a sense that maybe the education system is letting people down, and that a lot of the things that happen in Britain today are as a direct result of its colonial history? I mean, the immigration into the island of Britain occurred in the, if you like, the dying days of colonialism. Where people made their home, they felt an entitlement to make a home in Britain. And if you were to go back to the days of Enoch Powell and Rivers of Blood and all this sort of stuff, that you can see the seeds, if you like, of current difficulties being sown there. But they go back further. They go back to, if you like, the adventurism of the British Empire.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not an expert on education or what is being taught in schools at the moment, but I do find it remarkable that all of the things you've just mentioned are so absent from our discussions around immigration at the moment. You know, which is a subject we endlessly discuss in the UK, and endlessly actually accept Nigel Farage's and Reform's framing of the subject, which is that it's inherently a problem. And that is sort of extraordinary. Maybe it may be a failure of the education system. You know, maybe it's a failure of the culture and the quality of political discourse in Britain as a whole.
Is there anywhere in the world where that kind of integration, you know, ethnic, religious integration has happened successfully?
I think it was happening successfully here and in the rest of Europe until very recently. And, you know, I still wouldn't accept the idea that it's failing, really. What's happening is that the voices which are violently objecting to it and which would have been considered fringe 40 or 50 years ago have been allowed into the mainstream. And that's really kind of poisoned the political conversation, I think, in the UK in the last few years.
When you say allowed into the mainstream, I mean, if you like, the streams that are feeding the river of media are maybe social media streams, and that's how it becomes amplified, because the noise on social media it's a massive echo chamber.
It is, and social media has changed everything, really, in the way we talk and the way we conduct our affairs in the last 20 years or so, you know, in many ways for the better. But yes, it has also amplified voices which are often malign and intolerant and so on. And, you know, I sympathize with people in the mainstream media as to, you know, the dilemma about what to do about this, because you can't ignore those voices, I don't think.
Now, the fragmentation of British politics, smaller parties, it would seem like a good thing that you can have lots of parties representing different interests, be they the interests of the Welsh language, Scottish independence, the Green Party, even those on the right. It means that everyone has a voice. But in a first-past-the-post system in the United Kingdom, maybe, in spite of your popularity, you have no representation in Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has to be a reckoning with Britain's electoral system in the next within the next decade, I would say, because it no longer really fits the British political situation, the broad spectrum of opinions, and as you say, the fragmentation of opinion. You know, we have a mismatch, I think, a serious mismatch now between our electoral system and our actual political makeup.
Now, Andy Burnham, do you have high hopes for him? I mean, underspending on defence, overspending perhaps on welfare, what people observe in the local council areas, maybe refuse not being collected efficiently, etc. I could go on, housing, all of those things. But do you think Andy Burnham, with his high level of personal charisma, they say, can he deliver?
Who knows? I mean, you know, as a political novelist, I'm endlessly trying to keep up with the speed with which events evolve in politics these days, and that's now becoming a problem simply as a citizen as well. You know, we're still trying to catch our breath, really, over the, you know, the speed with which these things have been happening in the Labour Party. And yeah, sure, it would be nice to have a new injection of energy and dynamism and, as you say, charisma. You know, at the same time, a little bit of continuity would be nice, because, you know, 7 prime ministers in 10 years doesn't seem a very satisfactory way to run the country, really. And personally, although I had many reservations about some of the things he did and some of the things he said, I would have liked to have seen Keir Starmer given another year or two to prove himself.
Well, that's politics for you. A week is a long time, as we know. I suppose the last thing we should talk about is the World Cup, and with England facing a high-altitude tussle with Mexico in the Azteca Stadium, can England bring it home? And if they do, what impact might it have?
I only watch football once every 4 years when I in spite of myself, get caught up in the World Cup. And it's always a peculiar agony watching England play. You know, they try to torture their fans best they could. I mean, it happened in the last game when they, you know, let in a goal in the first 10 minutes of the match, and then spent the rest of the game trying to claw it back and so on. So who knows whether they can pull it off over Mexico. If they do, it will be in the most painful way possible and by the skin of their teeth, I suspect. You know, if they go further in the tournament or even to the final, then, you know, I think the country, as they always do when we're doing well in football, will go kind of berserk.
So you're going to be talking about the proof of innocence in your interview with Deirdre O'Shaughnessy at the Maritime Hotel in Cork on July 16th. I hope you have a great time there.
So do I. I'm really looking forward to it.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
With Timber Living Log Cabins.